Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of the channel, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books. This week, I'm happy to say we have Toby Green on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific book, The Rise of the Transatlantic Slave Trade in Western Africa, 1300 to 1589. I was just talking with Toby, and he said, why'd you pick this book? And I said, I picked this book because it's an extraordinarily important topic, and I know nothing about it. Which that's not good for, you know, the citizenry that I don't know anything about this. And I'm a professional historian. So I hope that you find it interesting, and I'm sure that you will. And let me thank Toby for writing the book and welcome him to the show.
Hello. Hello, Marshall.
All right. Well, I'm glad you're with us today. Could you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I'm a historian now. I teach in London at King's College London. I specialize in African history, West African history in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, its responses to Atlantic trade. I started off life after I graduated. I did my first degree in philosophy. I graduated. I won a travel scholarship, and I started off life as a travel writer. I wrote two travel books. One about South America, one about West Africa. And after the book about West Africa, I became more and more interested in the history, how West Africa came to be as it is today. So that was why I started a PhD when I was almost 30 at the Center of West African Studies in Birmingham University. And I've carried on from there, really.
Mm-hmm. So tell us why you wrote The Rise of the Transatlantic Slave Trade in Western Africa, 1300 to 1589. And by the way, one thing I really like about the title of your book is it doesn't have a semicolon in it.
Well, no, I do my best to please readers. You know. Why did I write the book? Well, when I started doing my PhD research, which was on a related subject, but not specifically on this subject, one of the things which I found really surprising and surprised me as somebody who came to academic research relatively late in life was that there was no monograph, there was no detailed study of the origins of the transatlantic slave trade. And there's plenty of books on the slave on the Atlantic slave trade in the 18th century, and of course a lot of work on abolition. But on the early period, there was really very little. There were some detailed studies of related aspects, quite a lot in Portuguese because a lot of the original sources are in Portuguese. But again, those books were often written partly during the dictatorship in Portugal in the 1960s and 1970s, so they weren't grounded in the kind of debates that current history is, and so I felt it was really surprising. I mean, actually, I do now know why no there wasn't a detailed monograph on this subject, which is that it took me 10 years to write. It required me to travel halfway around the world and ferret out bits of information in archives which claim not to have any. For example, one of the archives I used was the Archive of the Indies in Seville, which was the colonial archive for Latin America. And when I went there the first time, they said, well, where are you researching? And I said, well, I'm looking at the history of Cabo Verde. And they said, we don't have a section of documentation on Cabo Verde. So this was the kind of thing which I came up against. So it was really a bit like being a detective, finding information in many different sources all over the place, and that's why it took such a long time. So now I do know why no such book had been written, but that was how I came to think that this was a subject which deserved a book to be written about. And as you said, Marshall, you know, isn't it, it's a very important subject.
Yeah. So let me give you a brief sketch of what I knew about the origins of the Atlantic slave trade, and this will be sort of a caricature, and then you can tell us what modern historians think about it, and then you can tell us what you think about it. So what I knew was that the Portuguese set off in the 15th century. They went south. They got all the way to like the Gold Coast or someplace like that. They found these Africans. These Africans were already trading slaves, and they thought, geez, this will be great. It just so happens that these Spaniards are across the ocean, and we'll start taking slaves to them now, and they'll sort of set this up. That's what I knew from – I don't know where I knew that from. Yeah. And I don't know if any of it's correct. Now – So starting with that, where is that? You know, it's
okay. So okay. I mean, how do we unpick this? There are so many different levels of the history here. I mean, the first thing to start with, I think, is the concept of the idea of Africa in this picture. There's a wonderful book by a Congolese philosopher called Valentin Mudimbe called The Invention of Africa. Now, if we take ourselves right back to the mid 15th century, which is when Portuguese voyages along the Atlantic coast of Africa began. Africa is not a concept. You know, people don't know the geographical outlines of Africa. Mm-hmm. And somebody living in what's now Senegal has as much in common, or actually less in common, with somebody living in, say, Tanzania than they did with somebody in Portugal. Because actually what was in common, as I talk about in the book, between somebody in Senegal and somebody in Portugal was Islam. Mm-hmm. Senegal was the elite, the ruling elites in Senegal were Muslims by the 15th century. And of course, there'd been a long history of Islam in Spain and in Portugal with the reconquest from the whole medieval period. So actually, what we think of as Europe and Africa had, in the case of sort of Senegal and Portugal, had much more in common than somebody in Senegal would have had with somebody, say, in Tanzania or South Africa. And so the idea of Africa, which is what Mudimbe's book is about, was invented, really. It emerged out of the history of trade between the African continent and the rest of the world. And so when it comes back to where this trade started and how it began, somebody, for example, on the Gold Coast, as you say, in Ghana, and somebody, for example, in Senegal, would have had really quite little in common, even at that time. And so in many ways, when the Portuguese arrived, this idea that, for example, there was already a slave trade of Africans selling Africans, that's a misnomer, because, of course, it wasn't seen like that. It wasn't people in Senegal didn't see themselves as Africans selling other Africans. They thought themselves as people belonging to the Jolof, the Mandinka, the Fula tribes, who themselves were waging wars against their enemies and then selling war captives as slaves. So the definition of slave, the definition of Africa, all these things are, as soon as you start looking at it in detail, become quite complicated.
Mm-hmm. So that's my version. What do, and you may not be able to characterize this, I don't know. Your book is revisionist in a way. But what do your colleagues, or what is the received view on the origins of the transatlantic slave trade? That is prior to your book. What are you arguing against, or you're trying to adjust or amend?
There are several schools which have really emerged in the last 40 years. One of the main things which emerged in the late 1960s with a famous historian called Philip Curtin was the quantification of the slave trade. What was the magnitude of the slave trade? How many Africans, enslaved Africans, crossed the Atlantic, and what impact did that have on the African continent and, of course, on the New World? Well, one of the things the first, perhaps, revisionist element of the book is that, first of all, I bring new evidence from my archival detective work to suggest that the volume was much larger at the beginning of the slave trade than had previously been suggested. And then I show, through social changes and transformations in West Africa at that time, how the impact of that larger trade is manifested in social changes at that time. So that's one of the first things. Another major feature of the book is that I look particularly at social structures. I look at how there were already existing social structures in West Africa, which came out of the trans-Saharan trade. So for a long time, you'd had already since the 11th century, quite an active trade across the Sahara, particularly for gold, actually. Most of the gold in North Africa and in Europe at this time came from West Africa, but also in ivory and in slaves, and how the social structure which you had in West Africa was set up basically for long-distance trade. It was set up for long-distance trade from people coming from a long way away, in the previous case from North Africa across the desert, and they would have trading communities, diaspora trading communities, which were embedded in the local communities. And so when you have the Atlantic trade coming, when the Portuguese first arrived, there's already a social structure in place which will welcome long-distance traders like the Portuguese, allow them to have families, allow them to mix and settle into the community. And that's exactly what happened. They developed these mixed communities, African and Portuguese, the so-called Luso-Africans. And those communities became the bedrock of trade. They were like go-betweens between the Atlantic traders and Africans. And so what my book also argues is very importantly that the social structure of West Africa was fundamental in allowing that long-distance trade to take place in the first place.
Mm-hmm. A concept that is very important to the book is creolization. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So creolization is basically the manifestation of those mixed communities. So how do you develop a community where, for example, you may have no shared language, where you have very different social norms? Well, of course, the way you do it is you develop a kind of go-between community, a community which can relate both to both hosts, to both the Africans and to the Portuguese. And so how do you know that that sort of community has arisen? Well, one of the ways you know is the development of a different language, like a Creole language. Of course, Creole languages are well known from the Americas, from the Caribbean, from places like Haiti, islands like Curaçao. There's even in the American South, there's Gullah Creole. So you have that in the region of Cape Verde, and you have that in the region of Senegal, Guinea-Bissau, Gambia. From a very early time, we know that there was a Creole language spoken, and that's still there, actually. Creole is still, it's the national language in Cape Verde, and it's the main lingua franca in what's now Guinea-Bissau. So you have the development of this community built around a new shared language, which allows people to communicate and allows people to form a new mixed community. And so, and the idea is that that kind of creolization had already begun through the trans-Saharan trade, where you had long-distance traders also intermarrying in West African communities, also developing mixed social frameworks and using the Mandinga language as a main lingua franca. And so what one Brazilian sociologist calls primary creolization was already there and was key to enabling the mixed communities of the Atlantic world to develop. And of course, that was a very important step in the emergence of modern societies. Because if you look at New World societies, they're creole societies, they're mixed societies, they mix peoples from all over the world, from Europe, of course, from the Americas, Native Americans, but of course, many, many Africans, and many of those frameworks intermixed. And so the argument of the book really is that that framework, that Creole framework, actually begins in West Africa.
Mm-hmm. So the picture then that we should have is a place in which there are lots of different kinds of people, culturally speaking, mm-hmm. who communicate with one another through a Creole or communicate with foreigners, I guess we could call them that, through Creole. And this already exists when the Portuguese show up.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. What you have is Mandinga, which is the general lingua mm-hmm. franca in that region. Because so you have in the let's take it a step back. You have in West Africa prior to the Portuguese arriving, so in the 13th and the 14th centuries, you have the major empire, which is known as the Mali Empire, mm-hmm. and that covers what's now Mali, the Republic of Guinea, parts of Senegal and Gambia, and it stretches right down to the coast. And so the language of that empire, which is Mandinga, is like everybody's second language. It's the lingua franca of the whole region. And even today, if you go to Senegal, you'll find that a lot of people will speak Mandinga, even though that may not be their first language. So you have that as a lingua franca. Now, also, you have, very importantly, Arabic. So how do the Portuguese first communicate with people in Senegal or Gambia or Guinea-Bissau? Well, of course, as I've mentioned, many of the rulers are Islamic and there are Arabic scholars there. And of course, you've had this history of Arabic in Portugal and Spain. You've had the long history of Islam in Spain and Portugal, which means that there are Arabic speakers among the Portuguese. So actually, Arabic is also a very important first lingua franca. Then you have the settlement of the Cape Verde Islands in the late 15th century from the 1460s onwards. And that's where you get the Portuguese Creole developing. That's where you have enslaved Africans coming from West Africa to the Cape Verde Islands and developing a lingua franca with the Portuguese, mixing in general Portuguese vocabulary with Arabic grammar. With African grammatical structures. That's how you have the emergence of the Creole language. And then what I show in the book is how you have a constant crisscrossing. The Cape Verdes, people in the Cape Verdes are constantly moving back and forth, not only to the coast of Africa, because it's about 500 miles from Cape Verde to the African coast, but also to the Americas. And so that Creole language, which forms in Cape Verde, then moves to the African coast and becomes a lingua franca there as well.
Mm-hmm. Does it have a name? Did you say it still exists in Cape Verde?
It's called in Cabo Verde, it's called Creole.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And there are lots of speakers of it even today.
It's the language in Cabo Verde, in Cape Verde. But each island has a different variant, and that depends on the subsequent histories of the island. So, for example, the island of Brava, I gather you're in Massachusetts, Marshall. Mm-hmm. There's a big Cape Verdean community, as we were talking about, yeah. Who came on air in Massachusetts, in the Boston area, many of whom originate from the tiny island of Brava, which is the smallest inhabited island in Cape Verde. But in the 19th century, the whaling ships from New England often called at the Cape Verdes to pick up Cape Verdean crew. And so So, for example, the Creole of Brava has a lot of English words in it as a result of this. So there are little variants like that among the Creoles of the islands. Mm-hmm. But it's the main language of Cape Verde.
Mm-hmm. So is it proper to think then of the origins of the, let's not call it transatlantic, let's call it Atlantic slave trade, then is the trade back and forth between Cape Verde and the coast run by the Portuguese?
If you were looking at origins, yes, I think that's the first starting point.
There were plantations on Cape Verde, right?
You have the colonization of the Cape Verde Islands. You have, you have a need for labor. I mean, let's also remember that the real origin, as well, of the Atlantic slave trade is the need for labor. You know, why do you have a mass slave trade? One of the things I mentioned in the book: why do you have a mass slave trade from Africa to the Americas? Because the Native American population begins to go into sharp decline as soon as the Spanish arrive, and there's not enough labor in the Americas. And the same is the case in Cape Verde. You don't actually have a population in Cape Verde before the Portuguese arrival. It's not settled and inhabited. So if you're going to start a colony there, you need to find labor from somewhere. Now, actually, we should also remember that Portugal in the 15th century does not have a large population. It's only a century after the Black Death, which is, you know, in the middle 14th century, and the population is in recovery. In fact, the first slave trade is not only to Cape Verde, but also to Europe, to Portugal, and the African population who come to Portugal are very important in providing labor, as we see from a whole lot of sources. They provide labor in the docks. They provide labor clearing forests. So labor is at the heart of it. And in Cape Verde, there's no population, so you have to import the labor from somewhere. Mm-hmm. Now, so as Portugal has a small population, and Cape Verde is actually somewhere with a completely different climate and somewhere which people would be, in many cases, might be scared to go to. It's obviously, if you can, better to bring the labor from Africa. So that's the beginnings of the slave trade. And then, of course, as that picture of a lack of labor develops when you have the discovery of the Americas in the late 15th century. So you have the Cape Verde settled in the 1460s, and then, of course, Columbus reaches the New World in the 1490s. And then that picture of an absence of labor again becomes clear 10, 15 years later after that, then you have a similar process developing of the need for labor being paramount.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk a little bit about the religious landscape. You're very interested in culture, and some questions occurred to me. One is that how did Muslims and Christians, these Portuguese were Christian, obviously, how did they get along? Was there any sort of religious conflict there?
Well, I mean, it's not actually the case that all the Portuguese were Christians. I mean, one of the things about the book is that some of the sources come from the Inquisition archives. There was actually a large Inquisition, although it's famous as an Iberian institution, a Spanish and Portuguese institution, and of course a Roman institution, actually was concerned with the former colonies, with the colonies of those countries. And so there were Inquisition cases taken in West Africa, and particularly against the people who were known as New Christians.
New Christians, yes.
These were people of Jewish origin whose families were forcibly converted. So all the Jews in Portugal were forcibly converted to Christianity by Manuel I in 1497, and their descendants were known as New Christians to distinguish them from people who'd always been in Christian families who were called the Old Christians. Now, there were many restrictions placed on the new Christian population by Manuel I after they were converted. There were many things they couldn't do, and so many of them tried to emigrate, and places they went to were places like West Africa, where although there were Inquisition cases, the Inquisition was obviously a lot milder than it was in mm-hmm. Portugal itself.
New Spain, a lot of them went to New Spain.
And Spain. So first of all, that there was a mix of migrants. There were, of course, old Christians, many of them coming from Portugal, but there were also new Christians. And many of the traders who went from Cape, many of the old Christians were tended to be in administrative positions, in royal functions, and stayed on the islands. Many of the traders were new Christians who, because they couldn't get royal positions, because if you were a new Christian, you were barred, they became traders. So you had that kind of mix. And actually, the place of Islam is also important because in West Africa, as I've said, there were Islamic communities, particularly in what's now Senegal. And as some of these traders came from Jewish backgrounds, Judaism is, of course, recognized as the people who are Jews in Islamic theology have what's known as dhimmi status. That is, they are recognized as they can have a status within a situation. And so, in fact, where you actually have not only new Christians, but openly Jews settling in Senegal in the early 16th century, late 16th, early 17th century. They settle in Islamic areas because they're recognized by the king's jollof from within that framework. Whereas where there weren't Islamic kingdoms, where there were African religions, that seems to have been an area where, provided that people were prepared to adapt to African religions, to African social structures, to intermarry with usually daughters of royal family, African royal families, and adopt those religions, then anybody could settle. So you have both old and new Christians settling there.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, I think you raise a very important point that, you know, belief and religion and ritual, that's a fundamental part of the landscape at this time. You know, I mean, this is not a secular world. You know, at the heart of what everybody does is belief, and mm-hmm. That's very important.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the reasons I ask is my understanding of medieval Islam is that slavery is an accepted institution. It has been religiously authorized. No one thinks that there is anything irreligious or bad about it, and it has been done for hundreds of years. This is not really true in Western Europe. I don't know. You know, again, you can, if you're a Bible scholar, you can go back into the Old Testament and find a lot about slavery, but the New Testament it's not in the spirit of the New Testament. So, you know, we're right here at the origins of it. I wondered if they had any theories thinking about it.
Well, I mean, of course, very, very interesting you should raise those questions, which are, of course, very important. But as soon as mass slavery does start in the Atlantic world, people, of course, do immediately turn to questions related to the Old Testament ideas of slavery. You have the Hamitic hypothesis, which is supposed to justify biblically African enslavement, and so that's what happens. And in terms of the relationship between Islam and slavery, I think it's very important that we don't get confused by the term slavery. Slavery itself refers to many different institutions, and it's actually quite unfortunate that we always use the same word. So slavery, I mean, there's been quite a lot of literature on this subject, but so slavery in West Africa very much characterizes a relationship of dependence. But in before the Atlantic slave trade, somebody who was a domestic slave or a royal slave, their children could aspire to becoming part of the extended kinship group. Mm. They could aspire to losing that status. Whereas, of course, as we know in the Atlantic world, that was very much not the case. And that's how you get the emergence of a sort of racial element linked to an institution, which is very different. I mean, what you could say is, whereas in Africa, slavery is ultimately a way of including outsiders, including people who may be war captives or the children of war captives, and so who start off within a community as a slave, but then become incorporated into it and their children can become part of the community.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the Atlantic world, instead of including people in a broader community, slavery is very much a way of excluding people. You exclude people through the emergence of racial statutes and things like that, which marginalize communities and stop them from having the same rights as members of the colonial community. So it's a very different institution, I think. So whereas, yes, you might have instances of or a legitimation of slavery within both the Quran and the Old Testament, the ways in which that is then used is very different in the Atlantic context to how slavery was practiced in West Africa. So coming back to your original point, you know, what you said, what you knew about it originally, that slave trading was already going on, and then it was that was sort of used by the Portuguese to begin the Atlantic slave trade. Well, that's true, but the type of slavery was very different.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, I know that in the Russian context, the Russians practiced slavery well into the 18th century, I think, even after it was banned. The Russians did not practice field slavery. They practiced house slavery. So what is the distinction we should make in this context?
Well, I think a very important distinction in the African context is that slavery is very much connected to kinship. So it comes right back to family. And actually, anthropologists often describe slavery in Africa as a slave in Africa as being somebody who has no kin. So, I mean, that, of course, often will fit the situation of somebody who's a war captive. They're taken away from their kin, they're transported somewhere else, and they don't have a family. And so it's fundamental. And if you don't have a kin, you know, you lose all kinds of reproductive rights, you lose all kinds of social rights, really. And so that's a very fundamental aspect of it. And then, and there's a wonderful anthropologist who's worked on pre-Columbian slavery in the Americas. He's from Panama, called Fernando Santos Granero, and he's argued that a very similar structure exists in pre-Columbian America. But that system of kinship is not fundamentally tied to labor in the same way. I mean, I think the fundamental thing in terms of Atlantic slavery is the relationship between slavery and labor. As I said before, this is very much a question of labor. Why does this massive export of human beings take place? It's in many ways related to labor, and that creates a fundamentally different institution.
Mm-hmm. I just wondered how it occurred to the Portuguese to take this institution that they found, which was a kind of slavery, but very different from the kind of slavery that we're used to in, say, the American South, and adapt it to plantation work.
Well, I think this is something which develops very importantly, actually, on these Atlantic islands. So it develops in Cape Verde, and it develops in another archipelago, which I don't focus on very much in the book, which is the archipelago of São Tomé, which is much further south in the Atlantic, adjacent to what's today Gabon and Congo. So what you had in São Tomé was the emergence of sugar plantations, and that was actually the way in which this process emerged. You had a slow development of the plantation complex. It started in the Mediterranean, so sugar was originally being grown in islands like Cyprus in the eastern Mediterranean, which was under Islamic rule at the time. And that process was then transported by the Portuguese first to Madeira, first to the island of Madeira, which they settled in the 1420s and 1430s and also developed sugar plantations on. And when they first reached places like Senegal and Guinea-Bissau in the 1450s, some of the slaves which they traded went to work on the sugar plantations in Madeira. So that process is beginning there. Then when they reach São Tomé and begin sugar plantations in the late 15th century, in the 1480s and the 1490s, there's a slave trade already developing with what's now the nation state of Angola, which was known as the Kingdom of Congo at the time. And many slaves come from that region to São Tomé, and that's the first mass sugar plantation complex in the Atlantic world. And really, so it's a sort of, you could call it, these islands are really seedbeds. They're places to experiment. And of course, one of the fundamental things about them is that whereas on the Atlantic coast of Africa, as I've mentioned, traders had to adapt to African political systems, they had to intermarry and develop go-between communities, Creole communities. In the islands, the Portuguese are not subject to African political control. They can develop their own system as they wish once they have a labor supply. And so that was really the place where these processes of experimentation were fundamentally made concrete. And then that was transferred to Brazil. And in the 16th century, you do also have sugar plantations occurring at the same time in the Spanish Empire, in what's the island of Santo Domingo, which is the Hispaniola, which is what's now Santo Domingo and Haiti. And you have a similar process there. But the fundamental thing is these islands were places where both the Portuguese and the Spanish could experiment. And that's how that process of transfer from the Mediterranean with sugar production took place.
Mm-hmm. I have what might seem like an odd question, and you might not have the answer. I don't know. So my understanding is that the Quran forbids Muslims from enslaving other Muslims. Is that correct?
I believe that's the case, but I must say I'm not an expert on...
I don't know either. Let's just say that is the case, though. So I wonder if it, and again, you may not know, I wonder if it forbids a Muslim from becoming the slave of a Christian.
Well, I think that's simply, from what I know, that's not envisaged as a possibility within the Quranic scripture, because it has the concept of the dhimmi, which is the Christians who live subordinate to Islamic rule, but not the obverse. Now, and it's very interesting that you raise that point, because as I think the reason you do so, because some of the first slaves who went to the New World were Islamic.
This is why I do. Yes.
Yeah. From the Jolof people. Uh-huh. And as you imply, when they first arrived in the New World, they were the most serious rebels. On the island of Hispaniola, which I've just been talking about, by the end of the 1510s, so in about 1519, they are constantly fermenting revolts. And in fact, in the 1520s, a series of imperial decrees are passed by the Spanish Empire, by Charles V, banning the import of Jolof slaves. Huh. And it does seem to be this, that it's in part the fact that they are Islamic, which creates that, ferments that, that rebelliousness.
Yeah. I mean, that is exactly why I asked the question, because I can imagine that the Islamic authorities were probably a little bit taken aback when, or they were offended by the enslavement of their religious fellows. But that leads to another question. How did the Portuguese get the slaves when they first arrived? Well, how did they do that?
It should also be mentioned that the other thing about the Jolof was that they had a very important military history. They had a very large cavalry. They had a very, you know, they were, as I mentioned, trading across the Sahara for a long time for and then among the goods they got was weaponry. So it might also have been that they had that military capability already, partly because of that Saharan trade. Mm-hmm. How did they get the slaves? Well, I mean, it's very interesting. You know, at first they tried. In the 1440s, they tried raids. You know, they tried to. There was a history of raiding along the coast of what's now Mauritania and in Senegal. And then when they reached the Gambia River in the late 1440s, they had a military standoff and they couldn't actually. They lost. They were beaten by the Mandinga of the Gambia because, you know, let's remember, you know, the military technology of the Portuguese, the military technology of these terribly old rifles, especially in the rainy season, when the powder would get all wet, you know, was not really equipped to deal with us somewhere facing huge numbers of well-armed opponents who had access to weaponry through the Trans-Saharan trade. So when they reached the Gambia, they were defeated, and then they realized that trade was what they ought to attempt. And in fact, some of the Portuguese sources see that as, you know, the royal sources from the 15th century see this as a loss of honor that they'd started by trying to achieve captives through warfare, and then they'd lost their honor and begun to trade instead. But in the part of Africa which I write about, which is this region, Senegal, Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Guinea-Conakry, and Sierra Leone, it's through trade, and it's part of these trading mechanisms which developed on from the Trans-Saharan trade before. But of course, we also shouldn't generalize. As I mentioned at the start of the interview, you know, Africa is multiple worlds. So in Angola, for example, where the Portuguese colonialism and trade really gets going in the second half of the 16th century, warfare and colonial warfare is very important. Throughout the 17th century, you have armies, Portuguese armies and Brazilian armies, and using African allies often, waging wars in the interior of Angola, which are a very important part of the process by which slaves are exported to the New World. So it varies in different areas, but certainly in the area which I write about, it's particularly related to trade.
Mm-hmm. What did the Portuguese have that the, I don't want to use the word Africans because that covers a lot of ground, the people they traded with, what did the Portuguese have that these people wanted?
Well, one of the fascinating things is that especially the first two centuries, I mean, the early period, which is the period I write about, you know, what's essentially being traded are monies, currencies. So, you know, you have a lot of iron bars are a major form of currency. Cloths, which were known as panos, cloths were a unit of currency, particularly in Senegambia, but also in other parts of Africa, parts of Angola, parts of what's now Congo. You have copper. Copper is a major export, and copper rods are a form of currency in what's now Nigeria and Cameroon. And then you have cowries. Cowries, which the Portuguese, when they reached Asia, when they reached Goa, they brought cowries from the Maldive Islands back as ballast in their ships, which they would then trade in places like Benin in West Africa. So actually what is usually traded, particularly for the first century and a half of the Atlantic trade, is forms of money.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's interesting. So where did I'm having trouble with this word, the many kinds of Africans, let's put it that way, where did they get the slaves they traded?
So there were many different mechanisms for enslavement in West Africa. As I've mentioned already, warfare is one of them. And a very important one. You know, war captives are often seen as the primary victims of the transatlantic slave trade. But then within each kingdom, there were judicial processes related to enslavement. Criminals might often be sent into slavery, and also debt. There was often a correlation between a debtor and enslavement. You would often people would often be pawned, used as pawns as surety for debts, and if the debt wasn't paid, then the pawn could be sold into enslavement. So these were some of the key mechanisms for enslavement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there was no shortage of slaves at any time? Did the Portuguese get all they wanted? Or is it possible to answer that question?
That's a difficult question. There are times, in general, the Portuguese, the focus of the slave trade moved from one part of Africa to another as the human population shifted. So, for example, and a very good example of this is Angola. So my book focuses on the region I've discussed already, and that region for the 16th century was the major region for the transatlantic slave trade. But in the 17th century, certainly the first 60 years or so of the 17th century, when the volume of the slave trade really takes off, it's particularly Angola, which is the heart of the transatlantic slave trade. But then there's a major demographic impact on Angola. So we know that by the second half of the 17th century, Angola's population, particularly around Luanda, the capital, has been decimated. But that's when the focus of the slave trade then shifts to what's now the region of Nigeria, Benin and Togo and that part of West Africa. So in general, the trade shifts according to patterns of demography, warfare and violence and trade. And then by the 18th century, when Angola has population has recovered, then you have another focus on Angola. So those are the kinds of patterns which have a long period, although my book obviously doesn't deal with that whole period.
Mm-hmm. We already mentioned resistance. Could you talk a little bit about slave resistance?
Well, I mean, I think there are different types of resistance we ought to focus on. There's, first of all, I mean, one of the things that my book argues is that in general, it's the peoples in that part of West Africa I write about who are under most political pressure, who their leaders turn to the slave trade, hoping that alliance with the Portuguese will shore up their position. But while those elites make those alliances, as I show in the book, in every place where the Portuguese settle, the people often attack and burn down the Portuguese settlements, and they're not safe there. So actually, there's constant resistance from the people who are most likely to suffer from enslavement in the African communities themselves. Then, of course, when it comes to the history of forced migration, as the Nigerian historian Nene Kori put it, on the slave ships and in the slave communities, I mean, you cannot study the history of slavery without realizing that every time there's a slave community, there is resistance, there are escapees, there are runaway communities, the maroon communities, and that's a fundamental part of the institution of slavery in the Atlantic world.
Mm-hmm. We're almost done here. I know we've taken up a lot of your time, but I want to ask one question, which I think is very important, and I don't know the answer to it. You do touch on it in the book. At what point did slavery become racialized? And please talk about the area in which it wasn't, and then, you know, and the cultures in which it wasn't, and then how it became racialized.
Well, that's absolutely a very important question. And again, it's something which I think varies from place to place according to the time at which things happen. So, for example, in Cape Verde, one of the arguments of the book is that you do have racial ideas developing very early by the 1550s, by the 1560s, and that they are fundamentally mentally connected to this fact that this is the region where the major transatlantic slave trade is developing. And so you can trace connections from that to pictures which then develop in other parts of the Atlantic world, in Angola from the later 16th, early 17th centuries. But the idea of, I think actually you can trace this to the idea of Africa itself, as I mentioned, the invention of Africa. You can trace this very interestingly in the British slave trade. So the very first trading company of the British going to Africa, which starts in the 17th century, they don't refer to Africa. They refer to the company trading to what was called Guinea and Boni. So this is the coast of Guinea and Ben, what's now Nigeria. But then you have the Royal African Company developing in the 1660s. And so this is clearly a sign that Africa is a place, that Africans can be generalized. And that really, to me, suggests the growing racialization of the idea of the African by that time, and how it is, of course, fundamentally connected to the growing British involvement in the slave trade, just as that rise of that idea in Cape Verde in the 16th century was related to the Portuguese involvement in the slave trade at that time.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Toby, thanks so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it. We've taken up a lot of your time, as I said. I'd like to close the interview, if I could, with our traditional final question on new books in history, and that's, what are you working on now?
Well, my main project at the moment is I'm writing kind of a follow-up, which is on the 17th century, but it might extend a bit more than that. But it's really looking more comparatively. So comparing the region I've looked at now, particularly with the Angolan region, and their interactions with the Atlantic empires, and how the different interactions which they had tell us about the ways in which Africans were able to have agency in their relations with European trade, have that kind of political power which I talked about, but also how the different structures which they had shaped the different histories and trajectories which those regions had. And I'm particularly interested in economic history, actually. I mentioned in passing, you know, the import of currencies into West Africa, but I think that had a fundamental role in economic change in pre-colonial West Africa. And that's, of course, really important when we think about, or you know, the roots of African economic underdevelopment and its relationship to long-distance trade. I'm really interested by looking at how thinking about the import of currencies and economic changes related to that might have a really important way of helping us to look at economic change in Africa over the long durée. So that's what I'm trying to do at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Another 10 years?
I hope not.
I hope not too.
I've already had 15, so I'm not too bad.
Okay. Let me tell everybody that today we've been talking to Toby Green about his book, The Rise of the Transatlantic Slave Trade in Western Africa, 1300 to 1589. Toby, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Marshall. I enjoyed it very much.
Absolutely. And let me tell everyone who listens to this podcast, thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great week.